how did so many ancient cultures, separated by time and distance, share remarkably similar cosmological philosophies and religious symbolism? Today we have Laird Scranton back to talk about his latest book, Primal Wisdoms of the Ancients. Well, I'm Tony Sweet with Captain Ron. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told Studios, Laird Scranton. Laird, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You know, we're just trying to make this the best pandemic ever.
Hey, you know what? If you're going to do it right. That's what we say.
That's right.
well, we are excited to have you here. You have your brand spanking new book, and that's one reason I saw it. And I'm like, we have to have him on the show. And we have a lot of discussions, and I know this could go on probably a four-hour conversation, but we only have about 45 to 50 minutes, so we better get going. So your book, that you wrote, you have so many different books, and we were talking, and we're like, how does he continually write books? Is this information, new information coming out constantly, or how do you re-decipher and putting into a new book? And that said, let's figure out what is new in the book that hasn't been brought to other books.
Okay, well, what I do is I study comparative. It's a comparative study between ancient traditions to try to sort out, sort of triangulate in on original meanings on ancient symbols and ancient concepts. The trick is up front figuring out that we're talking about a single ancient system that is being represented in all these classic traditions like Buddhism and Hinduism and ancient Egypt, ancient Greece, right. Kabbalism, all sorts of other traditions. Okay, so in doing those comparisons, information turns up, the lion's share of which I don't know what to do with. There's only a small percentage of what I study that actually has meaning for me right at the moment. And so I sort of set it aside and say, let's leave this as an open question. Someday I'll figure this one out. Well, one day the right piece of information falls into place and an entire book's worth of information falls out because of it. There's such a backlog of things that one culture says that I can't validate against others.
Right.
So the new book is sort of an attempt to, this really is, a sitting back and a recapitulating or a surmising about everything that's been said in the previous book. There are aspects of ancient instruction. I'm working with what is described by the Buddhists and an African tribe called the Dogon,
right,
as an ancient instructed tradition. And so I've always wanted to talk about what is there about this system that insists that it had to have been an instructed tradition? Where do we see the hand of a very intelligent group of teachers revealed in this material? What techniques are they using that are instructional techniques that someone had to have deliberately put together rather than sort of fell together by coincidence or by accident? And so this book is sort of framing all that. It's talking about what can you do with a myth that you can't do with a symbol, or what kinds of metaphors were being used to convey information, and what kind of systematic approach was being taken to symbolism? You get into the mindset of what these people were talking about, and you start to be able to predict what ought to be there, and then deliberately go look for it and discover, hey, someone actually did take the time to lay this out the way I would have laid it out if I were putting it together.
Laird, you hit already.
So that's the upshot of the new book. Go ahead.
No, Laird, I was going to ask you. I mean, you already hit on like the big topic of your stuff, which is there seems to be teachers, at least in the Dogon and Buddhist traditions, that taught these guys. So we only have two options, which Tony and I have talked about 100 times on this show, which is we've either had advanced civilizations here on Earth develop higher technology, and they've got lost through time and went away, perhaps the Ice Age or what have you, or there's ET intervention, whether that be from another planet or interplanetary or interdimensional. That's up for debate as well. Where do you sit on that issue? Who do you think the teachers were?
Well, this is part of the reason why someone in my field of study can't expect an academic researcher to ever embrace it. It's because there's no answer to that kind of a question that's going to be acceptable from a traditional academic standpoint. But as you work with a material, you reach a point where you're compelled to consider the possibility that somebody in ancient times knew an awful lot that we don't think they knew. And that sort of postures you toward the question of who could that have possibly been. Well, my rule for myself, because the biggest threat to my work is my own wishfulness, my rule for myself is that every interpretation has to begin with what some ancient culture said. If they didn't believe it was true, I can't start chasing that as an interpretation. So the Buddhists and the Dogen, who have very closely matching symbolic systems, both say that they received it from a non-human source.
Wow. Okay.
Buddhism flatly says the most sacred of its symbols were gifted to humanity by a non-human source. The Dogen say not only was it non-human, it was originally non-material. So they're talking about a sort of cross-universes or cross-dimensional influence. But they say this was a situation where a group of teachers who were originally not material were able to take material form and take action in the material frame and actually instruct us. In the same way that Moses encounters an entity on the mountain that the Israelites are cautioned against approaching too close because it's dangerous. That sort of an interface. Although for the Dogen, these teachers actually took more of a human form. You know, in a number of the traditions, the teachers took human form. Ancient Egyptian words actually include pictures of what these people look like. They're represented as being small statured, and there are cultures all over the world that talk about them. In a manuscript I'm just finishing up, there's a traditional academic who says, in every ancient culture he's ever studied, there's some representation that humanity received knowledge or instruction from somebody more capable than them in ancient times. And then the academic inexplicably concludes, well, it's time to set all that nonsense aside. And I think if every single ancient culture is saying it, that's the reason that we want to embrace the idea and explore it and at least entertain the idea and see where it leads us. With the Dogen, where it leads us is to some really interesting things. It leads us to an understanding of a relationship between non-materiality and materiality.
See, that's
we lost that one.
Fascinating, right?
Yeah.
Well, also, doesn't that? I mean, this is the same Dogen tribe with the famous star map, right? That's
right, and
about.
That really is just the tip of the iceberg of what they talk about. They're, according to the Dogen priests, who are living priests in a living tribe of about 300,000 people, they say that their symbolic system describes how matter forms. It describes how their tribal god created the universe, created matter, created life. And so if we approach that, if we just entertain that for a moment to say, could this possibly be true, we see that they have definitions of an atom and the components of an atom, you know, electrons, protons, and neutrons, correctly described, correctly diagrammed. They understand how those things work. But they have a detailed descending set of stages that produce those structures. And so my first question was, is it possible that that's also scientific? Could someone have really known what they were talking about in ancient times and laid it out for us in a way that all we have to do is pay attention to it?
It's literally hard to believe. Tony and I, this is what I was going to talk about right before we came on, is that it's not like they had a higher knowledge, like they knew how to farm corn, which would have been a higher knowledge.
Right.
They knew, like, intricacies of science, like the atom and the inner workings of an atom and electrons and things and the universe, how it's been.
Right.
It's really pretty compelling.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually very compelling material. One of the books I published, there's an opening quote that basically says that to an intelligent mind, this is the only subject they should be interested in, the concept of how do processes of creation arise. And the Dogen have a really, really good fix on it. And using cross-comparison in a number of different modes to a number of different ancient cultures, you can, triangulate right in on what the original meaning was of a word or the original meaning of a symbol down to subtle nuances of what they intended to say. And all a person has to do is pay attention to that and follow it, and we arrive right at a perspective on how really odd things happen, like an entanglement between electrons and things like that.
It's incredible.
What is, I mean, for some of the people out there that may not know, or and I'm kind of even questionable on, what is the oldest symbol that's ever been found? Is it through the Dogon, or is it Egypt?
The
or
oldest... No, the oldest site right now that is a symbolic site is Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey. The problem is that it was in use about 6,000 years before written language. So most researchers don't have any way of getting a fix on what the symbols represented.
Right.
But symbols themselves go back much further than that. The problem is that once you bump into the Ice Age, you're really lost in terms of being able to connect what someone drew or carved on a stone and what they meant by it.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So is that about as far back as we're going? Tony's trying to hone in on a time period here. So it's about what, 12,000, 10,000 years ago was about when we started seeing symbolism like that you studied?
Yeah, for my purposes, that's about as far back as we can anchor an opinion about what a symbol means.
Okay.
But my late friend John Anthony West felt that there were things that go back at least another full cycle, which would be like around 30,000 BC.
Wow.
We're talking about a 24,000, 25,000 year cycle like the Yuga cycle.
Wow.
And there are people like Michael Cremo. If you're familiar with his book, Forbidden Archaeology, he documents things that go back, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. So it pushes back pretty far. It pushes back as far as anatomically modern humans.
See, that goes back to that argument that it's possible the alternative of the ET thing is that it's an advanced civilization that went away. But you're saying it's actually in the oral tradition that people came from another world, that they weren't human.
Actually, I see reasons to think that all three aspects of this could be involved. And it depends on the era that we're talking about, that I see influences that are non-material, that are sort of cross-universe influences. I see efforts from ancient civilizations such as what we talk about with Atlantis or with Mu or with Lemuria. And I see the possibility that there could have been off-planet influences, you know, traditional sci-fi alien influences also. And none of the cultures represent that there's just one of those things going on. We could have an intermix of different things. But the symbolic system ties, from my point of view, ties to the non-materiality first.
And then you can imagine that if let's say, the Dogon tribe learned something from, let's say, off-planet entities, if that happened, then they would maybe tell other humans who told other humans across the globe. And then they would say they learned it from other humans. But really it came from
yeah.
Right. That's sort of true, except that the way the symbolic tradition plays out, it looks as if whoever put the system together was an extremely capable group, and they deliberately instructed groups from regions all around the world. And that the reason that you see such similarities in symbols, you know, the archetypes, types of Jung and styles of stonemasonry and things like that that are match in very far distant places on the planet is because they all learned it from the same set of teachers. It's not that they necessarily got it from each other. They got it from the same common source.
Yeah, I find that with the masonry and masons, I don't know if you know much about them, but with symbolism with them, it's very important too. Have you seen any connections that the masonry had?
You're talking about Freemasons.
He
was talking about masonry of the old rocks, how they would meld together.
Yeah, because my grandfather was like a brick mason, so it's very similar. But they've all used symbols, and like you said, the pass down of symbols to different tribes, to different civilizations. But I'm just talking about the symbols, how it's important with all these ancient, like even Greeks, you know, talked about the symbols and the gods and stuff like that. So when it comes to
Egypt, and you said Buddhism and Dogon are very similar. Now, Egyptian, what is there any type of rollover into Egypt of their symbols? Are you seeing that there a connection between those two? I know I'm trying to think. Anyway, Dogon and Buddhism, are you seeing any connection with Egypt itself? Because
yes, as a matter of fact, the Dogon culture, if I had perfect knowledge before I started, I would have picked the Dogon culture as the place to begin, because they are a living culture, a modern-day culture, who have strong influences from at least three ancient traditions. They have their language, the cosmological language, many of the words are ancient Egyptian words, so you can use Egyptian hieroglyphic language to compare things. A lot of their civic traditions are ancient Egyptian civic traditions from around 3000 BC.
Wow.
They have rituals that are a lot like ancient Judaism, and they have a symbolic system that's a lot like ancient Buddhism. Plus, they have symbolic elements that tie out directly to Hinduism. So there's all sorts of stuff going on with the Dogon. The Dogon are an excellent starting point, and I just sort of fell into that. I didn't know to pick it when I started.
What a lucky do you believe in synchronicity?
Absolutely.
All of this rests on a very old philosophy in India called Samkhya, which was a counterpart to yoga. And Samkhya says universes form in pairs, one non-material and one material. And the non-material universe has perfect knowledge, but an inability to take action, whereas the material universe has imperfect knowledge and full ability to take action. And so Samkhya believes that there are routine efforts being made from the non-material side to convey knowledge and to induce certain actions on the material side. And that happens through synchronicities, through vivid dreams, through the unusual behavior of animals, through clairvoyance, all of the paranormal sorts of things, that all of the occurrences that happen that we consider to be paranormal. There are a number of different ways that the non-material side is trying to communicate with the material side. I even see connections to alien abduction and alien witnessing encounters. They express themselves through the same symbolism that I'm studying.
Wow.
I see it with vivid dreams, that very often I can put an interpretation on a dream based on the images in it, because they play out in the same clusters and the same relationships as the symbols I work with. So I actually reached out to Whitley Strieber, if you know who he is, a few years back. Talk about it. Well, I discovered when I finally got a hold of him that he had been trying to reach out to me. And
that's a synchronicity.
There's another researcher, the late John Mack, who wrote a book called Passport to the Cosmos. And he opens the book with a chapter that summarizes his perspective on where he's arrived at in terms of his understanding of this UFO and abductee type encounters. And I could have written the chapter. It was so on point with how I see things, coming at the subject from a completely different direction, that I was really astounded to see it.
That's fascinating. That is a fascinating nugget right there. I like that. Seriously. John Mack stuff's great. He also wrote the book Abduction, which is awesome. That's interesting stuff. Yeah, that is incredible. It's interesting how many different disciplines have this in it, within it. Like you were talking about that. I was immediately thinking about the afterlife people and how it's like you keep saying materialism and non-material worlds. Well, that's like near-death experiences, and it's the afterlife people, and it's the alien thing, and it's the interdimensional thing. All of them.
All the same stuff. They have an awful lot in common. I mean, from the Dogon perspective, an atom is a subdivision of a grand source of energy, in the same way that individual consciousness is a subdivision of a grand source of consciousness. With esoteric Buddhism, one of the final stages of enlightenment is finally coming to a realization that it's all one consciousness. So for the Dogon, everything that is important, anything that has any real significance, resides on the non-material side, not the material side. It's sort of like when you're streaming a show on your television set, it doesn't reside in your television set. It resides at the source that you're streaming from.
You know, he sounds just like the guys that are talking about consciousness right now.
Right.
The front-running guys in consciousness talk about being receivers. And that's what you're talking about. And here the Dogon tribe's talking about. That's compelling to me.
It is to me, too. That's why I've been at it for, like, 25 years.
It really is. It's incredible.
Have you ever had a chance to, like, really dive into the tribe, like, going and observing and doing through museums and through just word of mouth or just visit? Because that's fascinating to know this tribe has so much knowledge, and yet we as human beings, we just seem to...
Nope, we don't pay attention to it.
We pay attention to this knowledge, and it's useless.
Yes. Well, I haven't actually spent any time with the Dogon tribe. I've been close friends with people who have, but there's a reason for that. It's because the way the esoteric tradition is structured, it's until they have confidence that the person who's asking the questions has a base of knowledge to be asking those questions from, they're required to remain silent or to lie if they have to. It's like a 20-year process for an initiate to work with an informant and gain this knowledge.
Well, there was a guy.
Much the same figure we hear about. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Laird. I was going to say, isn't there a guy? I can't think of his name. There's a guy that was like a French guy who did infiltrate the tribe and become.
Yes, he's my primary source. His name is Marcel Griot.
Marcel Griot, that's it.
And he was the leading anthropologist of Europe in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. And every year he would take a team into Dogon country, and they would, over the course of 30 years or three decades, they studied the tribe. He ended up being initiated in the tribe and granted Dogon citizenship.
Wow, that's crazy.
And when he died, he was given a Dogon burial. So this is how well the guy understood the inside track on this tradition.
How cool is that? Yeah, it's amazing that nobody in the world talks about this. I bet a lot of people wouldn't know what the Dogon tribe is. And it's incredible to me how I feel like this knowledge is sitting there and we're not looking at it. I mean, you're looking at it, but I feel like a lot of the world isn't. Don't you feel like it's sitting right there?
I do. There's a gentleman who is involved with an African healing tradition. He's actually he was born into the Dagara tribe, which these are cousins of the Dogon. And he was abducted from his home when he was a child and taken away and educated in a Western tradition. And then when he was around 16, he went back and asked to be initiated in the Dagara tribe, which was a difficult process. He was came out of all of that realizing he had a foot in both traditions. He had a firm understanding of what the Western mindset is like and what the Dogon and Dagara mindset is like. And he's written a number of books about it. And it's amazing to me because here's a guy who actually has a basis to be talking about the things I write about. I was astounded to be actually on the same page with him also about how he represents things, how he understands certain things. So I feel like I've been very lucky to have had found the right sources to be able to look at.
Have you found that a lot of these symbols in ancient civilizations, the creation of religion when it comes to how we describe it today, because you talk about it in your book about religion, and I'm just trying to figure out, did the difference between, you know, we call it New Age and religion, because what I hear you talk about is more spiritual side of than versus religion. How are these symbols, how have they influenced religion itself?
Okay, the classic religious traditions that we're familiar with mostly center around the year zero. That's 2,000 years earlier than we are.
Right.
The traditions I'm looking at are 3,000 years before that, at least, from 3,000 BC to 9,000 BC.
Mm-hmm.
So they're actually further removed from Christianity and Islam and all of the modern traditions than we are from Christianity. So for me, all of those classic religious references are out of date. They're too far distanced from from the material I'm trying to get at to be able to count on for anything important.
Because
where Christianity...
No, go ahead.
Where Christianity poses an opposition between good and evil, the Dogon say truth and error. The Dogon is a very less judgmental sort of approach to things. The idea is it's not that an initiator who gets something wrong has evil intent. It just means he tried and he didn't get it right. Now you get another try at getting it right. You just keep trying until you do get it right.
Now look at how that fits today. Today that's a great mantra.
Right.
And here it's 5,000 years old or whatever. But that makes sense today, right?
Right.
I like that.
Right. Well, if I were to ask you what you felt an owl symbolizes, what would you say?
Wisdom.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's
the wise old owl, as we learned.
Okay. Okay, a lot of times I'll comment that to somebody who I know has never studied any of this stuff, and I'll say, look, that's 5,000-year-old symbolism that without even ever having studied the subject, you understand. That's how tenacious these symbols are. They carry their meanings through in very, very credible ways and very tenacious ways. So this is whoever put the symbol together had mad skills in terms of coming up with intuitive ways of communicating ideas.
Yeah, do you feel these were put there to stand the test of time? Like these beings perhaps knew that humanity would be looking at them for thousands of years?
Well, the material insists that their target audience was a technological one. You don't talk about entanglement of electrons and things more fundamental than that, except to a technological audience, because all of the references, all the drawings, all the descriptions are only going to make sense to somebody who has microscopes and telescopes and whatnot.
Right.
So they automatically were aimed at a target audience that was thousands of years out from where they were at. And that's quite a trick, because if I want to frame a metaphor to help you understand something, that only works if I know what your frame of reference is. It's only if I can pick a metaphor that I know you understand, something that I can compare. You know, if I can compare A to B, I have to know that you understand B.
Correct. You have to have the right frame of reference.
So to get around that, they don't use just one metaphor to convey an idea. They convey it, you know, half a dozen different ways according to half a dozen different metaphors, hoping that one of those is going to resonate with whoever the audience ends up being.
It's fantastic.
So, what do you think what's the parallel between Dogon and Judaism? Is there any connections?
Many of the Dogon words are also ancient Egyptian words, but are also ancient Hebrew words. So it's at root, this is the same system. There is a connection between the two. If I had to. It's a complicated path by which the original tradition gets to Judaism. It's not a direct path. Although there's one direct path down through Palestine, which probably conveyed a lot of it. But there's a second path that passes over through northern Scotland and then back into the Mediterranean and back to ancient Egypt that conveys a bunch of it. The first Jewish temple in ancient Egypt was founded around 4000 BC at Elephantine. And there were a group of stonemasons called the Habiru, who are either Apiru or Habiru, who worked at Gebel El Sassila, the stone quarry. So, and that's not far distant from where Elephantine is. So there are connections through Egypt, but from my point of view, those connections are not primary. Egypt is secondary to these other paths of transmission I was talking about. I'm finishing up a manuscript right now that ties all of that together, that explains here's how it is that the tradition worked its way from Göbekli Tepe to these other localities, how it gets to Scotland, how it gets back to ancient Greece, how it gets to Egypt, places like that.
Do you ever stop writing? Because it doesn't seem like you do. I'm working on a manuscript. I've got one here. I've got another one in the can. I've been working on this. Amazing. It's great that you're sharing all that with us. I love it. I have a symbol for you to talk about that's known throughout these different cultures that we've talked about in the alien community. What about these little handbags? handbags that,
okay,
these
guys, that
the men carry? See, Tony, it's a good question. Tony's laughing at me, and you said good question. Because it is something to it, right?
He carries a handbag, so.
Tony started a question to frame a question earlier about are there any symbols that carried over into the Masonic tradition from Göbekli Tepe? Well, one of them did carry over. At least one that I can point to did carry over. It looks like the letter H in English. And what it represents is the energetic connection between non-materiality and materiality. And that's a concept that carried over into the Masonic tradition. I actually quote an article from around 1900 out of the New Age magazine, which is a Masonic magazine, and there's an entire article about the symbolism of this H as it's understood by the Masonic tradition. It's one of the references I use to justify the interpretation. But at Göbekli Tepe, you have a half dozen or more different symbols that all represent that same concept. You know how I was saying that whoever put the system together wasn't sure what metaphors would resonate, so they picked half a dozen different metaphors to express a thing? Same thing with the symbols. When you go to Göbekli Tepe, pretty much every symbol you can point at there, from my point of view, there's a rationale for seeing that it represents that same concept of non-material and material energies coming together. That's the definition of a sanctuary. It's a place where non-materiality and materiality come together.
That is the thrust of your thinking. It is. That it's, everything is about the material and right, the non-material. That does seem to be a real central focus in your way of thinking.
It is. It comes out of Sankhya. That's how they frame things, and the Dogen think the same thing. The handbag shape connects to that same concept. The idea is, and there are scientific reasons for this symbolism, that circularity associates with non-materiality, and squareness associates with materiality.
Again.
So these shapes, you see them on the Göbekli Tepe pillar. You see three carved handbag shape with a hemispheric top, a circular top, and a square bottom. That's a way of representing the idea of non-materiality and materiality coming together. More familiarly, in ancient Egypt, you know, the year began with the heliacal rise of Sirius. That's the day, because of the way celestial mechanics work or orbital mechanics work, Sirius, which is the brightest star in the night sky, disappears from our view every year for a number of days because it's falling in the glare of the sun. We can't see it through the glare. And then finally, one day in the middle of summer, it rises just ahead of the sun and we can see it again. That's called the heliacal rise of Sirius. Well, Sirius is an icon for the non-material domain, and the sun is an icon for the material domain. So that celebration of the heliacal rise, the Dogen refer to as Sirius meets the sun, this is another representation of that same concept. You've got it again and again and again at the Göbekli Tepe. You have it in other traditions also. Now, from another perspective, the Dogen cosmology is sometimes referred to as the basket cosmology. One of the reasons for that is because there's an important shrine in the Dogen tradition that is a symbol, a major symbol of the tradition. It corresponds to a stupa shrine in Buddhism. And a blind Dogen priest was trying to explain to Marcel Griol what the shape of the shrine was. And so he reached back into his hut and sort of reached around until he found a wicker basket that was square on bottom and round on top. And he turned it upside down so the round top was sitting on the ground, the square piece was sitting at the top. Well, that basket represents that same symbolism as reconciling a circle and a square. A circle is symbolic of non-materiality, the square of materiality. In the Maori tradition in Polynesia, in New Zealand, one of the departmental gods of the Maori was said to have ascended to the gods and returned with three baskets of knowledge. So a basket becomes a symbol for this esoteric knowledge. Even in Egypt, the earliest shrines, portable shrines that they had in Egypt, were made out of wicker, and they were in the same shape with a rectangular base and an arched top. And all of the other later shrines were based on that as a pattern.
Incredible. Isn't it also that the sun goes down and that's the material world that is during the day and sort of the sun has gone to the non-material world. Wasn't that somewhere in there?
Right. That's an important concept also, because there are two modes of time we're talking about. We're talking about time as it's experienced non-materially, and time as it's experienced materially. Materially, we see a linear arrow of time. Non-materially, they see an oscillation of time. We see moments that the Dogen characterized as glimpses. Non-materiality sees much larger moments of time they characterize as glances. One of the ways the difference is really rooted in how fast time, the rate of time passes, how fast moments pass. I compare the dynamics to a cassette tape and a CD. With a cassette tape is linear. If you want to hear a song in the middle of a cassette tape and you don't have a fast forward button, your only choice is to listen to it all the way through from the start till you get to the song you want. With a CD, you can skip around. You can go to any place you want to go.
Right.
That's the essential difference between non-materiality and materiality in terms of time.
I also find it fascinating, like Tony's bringing up that religion into this, how early religions sort of talk about a non-material world, the heavens and the angels and all that, and then our material world here. It's interesting how that also ties right in.
Right.
And concepts evolve over time. I mean, where the Dogen are talking about, the Dogen as a society are dedicated to preserving original forms. So most often, whatever the Dogen are doing, my impulse is to think that that's the original form. It's the older of the forms. It's true with this shrine and the Buddhist shrine. There are compelling reasons to think that the Dogen version is the original version, and the Buddhist version is sort of a mutated version that happened later on down the line. Well, where the Dogen are talking about stages and concepts of creation, the Egyptians are talking about deities who represent those same stages and concepts of creation. And they're symbolizing them, okay, where in the Dogon culture, the symbolism might be to a particular set of animals. In Egypt, suddenly you have a deity with that animal as their head representing the same concept. Hmm. Or you go to India and you see that same concept represented by a deity who has that same animal as an avatar. In India, you can have a situation where the same deity might be represented in 500 different villages under different names. But the researchers can always tie them together because the avatar is the same. You can tell by the avatar who they're really talking about. Oh, they're really talking about Devi here, or they're really talking about, Shiva. They're really talking about Ganesha, that sort of thing. The avatars are important. So the relationship of the symbolism sort of has a progression over time. And the modern classical religions are an ultimate sort of expression of that. Things have morphed and morphed and morphed and morphed. And to get back to the original, we have to find cultures where that didn't happen. And the Buddhists and the Dogen are two of those cultures where that didn't happen.
That's fascinating.
That is fascinating.
Did you have a question?
No.
I have one for you. What about we always see in symbolism, these ancient cultures always seem to think the equinox was very important and everything was built around lining that up. What do you find that to mean?
We talked about the cycle of energy that happens. It's essentially the yuga cycle. In Dogen language, the Dogen also preserve original syllables of language. And for the Dogen, the syllables are symbolic the same way that a symbol is in ancient Egypt, that the symbol represents a concept. So with the Dogen language, you, the syllable YU, refers to a gateway between non-materiality and materiality. This is a structure of matter that sits sort of at the interface between the two domains. And ga is a syllable that represents the concept of temporality or time. And so yuga is a gateway that regulates temporality, regulates the flow of time, the flow of energy and time. So now one way of thinking of that is as a cycle, and one of the largest cycles we're familiar with is the cycle of a year. So they compare that. They call it the great year. Now,
right.
The perspective is that energy scrolls from the non-material universe, for one, actually from one universe to the other and then back again. And it's not just energy that's scrolling, it's energy and mass that's moving from one side to the other. The same, you can think of an hourglass with sand in the top globe that slowly sifts into the bottom globe. Only what's sifting is energy. And with that energy and with that mass, you're changing the time frame of the universe. Einstein says that as a thing becomes more massive, time runs more slowly for a more massive object. So as our material universe becomes more and more massive, time slows down. Hmm. Now, with the hourglass, you can picture that there's a point in the center of the process, the middle of the process, where there's the same amount of sand in the top globe as there is in the bottom globe. At that point, which corresponds, if we relate that great year to this cycle of energy, that midpoint happens once each half cycle. So it happens midway through a 13,000 year cycle. If our cycle
a 26,000 year cycle, right?
Go back to 10. Right, 26, yeah, 25,920,
right.
I think is
the
number that works, that ties out best. Midway through that cycle, which corresponds to the era of about 3600 BC, which is the era of Northern Scotland I was talking about, the time frame should have equalized because the mass in the two universes has equalized. Now, we know if we go in a submarine, where down under the ocean where there's a heavy pressure from water, it's not safe to move out of the submarine into the water unless you pass through an airlock first. And the purpose of the airlock is to equalize the pressure with what it is outside before you move outside. Same thing with the universes. This, when the time frames equalize, it becomes theoretically possible to move for a being on the non-material side to move to the material side. And that's what the Dogons say happened. Is their teachers opted at that point in time when it was possible to move across to step into materiality and help us out.
Laird, you came on here to talk about symbols, like where people used to carve X's in the ground and stuff. And you're talking about Einstein stuff here. Unbelievable. That is fascinating.
Well, that's where it goes.
Right,
it's
right.
Absolutely fascinating.
The equinox is important.
Yes.
The equinox becomes important because of that. Now, what happens at the equinox in Judaism? They celebrate a holiday called Passover.
Hmm.
The word for equinox in ancient Egypt is Kepher. Kepher is the name of the dung beetle who represents non-existence coming into existence. A traditional Passover Seder ends with the opening of a door to the outside to let a non-material entity named Eliyahu come in.
This
so
is amazing.
A Passover Seder is acting out the very process the Dogon are saying happens. So that's the root reason why the equinox is an important time. It also has to do with energetics, that when energy is being communicated from the non-material to the material, that's the place where it sees least resistance coming across that boundary.
Hey, Laird, exactly what you're talking about right now. I think we've heard this, Tony, on the show about people that talk about the afterlife and things. That's the time, I think the witch that came in here, Patty may have mentioned this too, that's the close time where it's easier to pass over between the worlds.
The thinning of the layers of the...
Right.
That's interesting that also ties into these other realms.
Well, I mean, actually, and they've talked about many times...
Right, because...
Go ahead. I think there's a little delay. So go ahead.
Okay. The occult is another side of this. For the Maori, anyone who studies what I study is forbidden from studying the occult. A priest or an expert who's being taught about cosmology or about the occult has to make a choice early on in their schooling. Which way are you going to go? Are you going to learn about the occult, which for the Maori is very dark knowledge, or are you going to learn about the cosmology, which is more positive and more light type of knowledge.
Well, I mean, time's almost only have about three more minutes. And first of all, I want to thank everybody in the chat room. And,
absolutely.
For joining us. Lakeem, thank you for the donation. We really appreciate that. And all the people that are commenting. This is definitely a subject that we don't get to talk about enough. I still find it fascinating that the Dogon is still intact and pretty much from what it was, you know, thousands of years ago, where so much of the other civilizations, even look at Egypt, how it's become just, you know, in the 21st,
modernized.
Yeah, modernized in the 21st century, and we're hoping to save all these symbols. So, and we need people like you to keep this going, and thank you for doing that. But where can people pick up your book? And, you know, is there a website? Yeah, please let, because there's a lot of people that are interested in this.
Well, the easiest place to find me is on Facebook. I'm the only Laird Scranton on Facebook. You can
I think
find
you're the only Laird Scranton on the planet.
Certainly there aren't very many people who are, get Laird as a name. Very
right.
few who can pronounce it the first time or even recognize it as being.
That's great.
My publisher, Inner Traditions, has an author page for me. There's also one at simonandschuster.com. Those are the best places to try to find me.
Well, we can't wait for the next book to come out and have you on the show and talk about that. And
next
as
week,
because
he cranks them out.
Right. And we definitely want to have you back, and we have a lot more to discussion. And thank you for sharing your knowledge.
Yep, I'd be happy to come back anytime. Thanks a lot.
Very interesting stuff, Laird. Thank you very much.
And thank you guys again for tuning in. Thank you for donating. We really appreciate that. And we thank you guys for just supporting us all these years. And I hope you guys share this show and leave us comments and reviews. And check out our not only our video on our YouTube channel, where we want you to subscribe, but listen to our Apple Podcast, iHeart, Spotify, all those, you know, podcast outlets. Just it's called Truth Be Told. But until next time, I'm Tony Sweet with Captain Ron. We'll see you hopefully next week.
Next week.
Bye. Take care.